You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of November 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be taking the independence temperature in Barcelona and Madrid following yesterday's surprising Catalonian election.
Well, while this result does provide relief for Rajoy's government and the rest of Spain, it doesn't necessarily mean that the independence question has been set to rest.
We'll be finding out more about the new governor of the Bank of England, current governor of the Bank of Canada, Mark Carney. He was once voted most trusted Canadian, no less. And over in the Congo, we'll get the latest on the situation from Ben Rawlance, author of Radio Congo.
Either M23 have to go the whole hog to try and take Kinshasa to justify this preliminary move, or they've got to then negotiate. But what are they going to negotiate on the basis of an illegal occupation of a town backed by a foreign power?
All that, plus we'll interrupt our New York bureau chief Aisha Spears on her lunch to get the headlines there, and we'll also play a few catchy tunes too. That's all to come over the next hour here on Midori House. So lots to get through in the next hour, but first let's get the latest news headlines with David Spencer.
Demonstrations are continuing in Cairo's Tahrir Square as the Egyptian president claims the country will survive the latest political crisis. Protesters are angry at a new decree which has given President Mohamed Morsi sweeping new powers. More than 500 people have been injured in nationwide protests, but these tourists say they don't feel unsafe.
They need the tourists here. They need the tourist industry in Egypt is so huge. So, yeah, I don't think it's something that would really involve us or should concern us at all.
We've come down to Cairo and absolutely no problem at all. We've had a wonderful time.
Syrian jets have bombed a rebel stronghold along the border with Turkey 24 hours before Ankara holds talks with NATO about stationing missiles in the region. The bombing comes as Syrian activists say 10 children have been killed after a government jet dropped a cluster bomb on a playground in a village east of Damascus. The government's denied that the military has any cluster bombs. Eurozone finance ministers are in Brussels alongside the head of the International Monetary Fund to try and hammer out a deal that will unfreeze the second bailout package for Greece. It's the third time they've met. EU Commissioner Olli Rehn hopes a deal can be finalised.
It's important for Greece, important for Europe, and I want to encourage all the euro area member states and the IMF to go the last mile in order to find an agreement. Go the last centimetre because we are so close to an agreement.
The UK government has made a surprise choice for the next governor of the Bank of England. Canadian central bank chief Mark Carney will take over from Mervyn King in July next year. Britain's Chancellor George Osborne made the announcement in the House of Commons.
He is quite simply the best, most experienced and most qualified person in the world to be the next governor of the Bank of England and to help steer Britain's families and businesses through these difficult economic times. Britain needs the very best at a time like this, and in Mark Carney we've got him.
And we'll be hearing more on that appointment on Midori House this hour. Governments around the world are still not doing enough to reach a target on climate change, according to non-profit organisations attending a conference at the United Nations in Qatar. They're concerned that a global get-together by almost 200 nations in Doha will ignore the issue of rising greenhouse gas emissions. Shares of two loss-making private Indian airlines, SpiceJet and Jet Airways, have risen sharply following reports that foreign carriers are in talks about buying stakes in the operators. SpiceJet says it's very premature to comment on the possibility of any deal. Jet Airways has declined to comment. That's the latest on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David. It's 18:04 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen, Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu é Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. And we start the show in Catalonia. The result of yesterday's vote was widely unpredicted by polls. Separatists in Spain's Catalonia won the elections, but at the same time they failed to get a resounding mandate for a referendum on Catalonia's independence. Catalan President Artur Mas had called an early election to test support for his new drive for Catalonia's independence. However, voters, frustrated with the economic crisis, handed almost two-thirds of the local parliament's seats to four different separatist parties. President Mas's own group saw the number of its seats fall quite considerably. So what does this result mean to Catalonia? Does this make the future independence less probable? To tell us more, we're joined on the line by Christian Segura, writer and journalist for the ARA paper in Barcelona. Christian, thank you for joining us. Perhaps you could start just by saying how the polls did manage to get it so wrong and why the vote was such a surprise.
Well, first of all, this is a great surprise because it has been unexpected and has been a vote against the speech of the great media, big media here in Catalonia, and also a big lobbies in Barcelona who were asking for a big vote for Artur Mas. They didn't expect that the population, the society has its own idea of what has happened, and what has happened is that we had here a big cut on our welfare and social services. So what happened is that people vote for left-wing parties that are in favor of a referendum or a call to ask if we want to be part of Spain or not, whether or not we want to be a part of Spain. But they have punish Mr. Mas, President Mas, because they don't support his economical and social politic management.
So it's a vote against Artur Mas and what he stands for, rather than a vote against the referendum for independence.
Yes, it's now the referendum has come in a very difficult position because it's clear that a test against Madrid like the referendum means that Catalonia needs a strong leadership, and actually Artur Mas is weaker than yesterday. So now he has to ask to create a coalition for a new government with Esquerra Republicana. This is the top left-wing party in Catalonia nowadays, or with the Partido Socialista, Catalonia Socialist Party, linked to Madrid Socialist Party. They should decide if they want to create a government with a clear independentist position or a more pragmatical.
And is that likely to work, do you think? Are either of these potential coalition governments natural allies? Will they provide a stable coalition government, do you think?
This is the point. I mean, the ruling party, Convergencia Unió, is clearly divided on this issue. Half of them don't trust on this Esquerra Republicana, independentist left-wing party, because they are clearly against how Artur Mas has dealt with the economy. The more pragmatical ones believe that it is easier to create a government with the Partido Socialista of Catalonia, that they are more pro-Spain, but it means that they will have support of Madrid in several other ways.
Indeed. Well, we'll be keeping a close watch on events as they unfold in Catalonia. Christian Segura, writer and journalist for the ARA paper in Barcelona, thank you very much. And to continue with the reactions in Madrid, we're joined now by our correspondent there, Liam Aldous. Liam, thank you for joining us. It's a victory of sorts for Mariano Rajoy, it seems, or is that what he's claiming it is?
Well, you've kind of seen the PP or the heads of government or the main PP figures come out today and celebrate this kind of loss of mass, but it's kind of a short-sighted celebration because they've come out and said some very strong words. Rajoy came out and said that Mas lost. His whole political strategy has been proven to be a complete fiasco. Santa Maria, the vice president, said that Mas has been dealt a massive blow and needs to really reassess his priorities, namely focusing on employment and building the economy. And the foreign minister came out and said this was good for Catalonia, good for Spain, and good for Europe. But they seem to be ignoring the fact that Independence Party still won a majority and the referendum question is still on the table.
Exactly. Short-sighted, as you say. And if anything, these sorts of reactions will only fan the flames, presumably, of people who are pro-independence in Catalonia.
Exactly, and Rajoy said something that really kind of dug the knife in. He kind of put salt in the wound, if you will, to Mas. He said that Mas called these elections for no reason, and he displayed a complete disloyalty to those in the PP who are actually supporting him. Rajoy has actually been supporting the CIU's budgets over these last 2 years. Actually, their austerity policies are quite aligned. Actually, they may seem to be against each other, but their politics aren't that different. Just the independence question. But then Rajoy said that. Mas went on ludicrous missions like going to Russia, and this was a reference to a recent trip Mas made to Russia to try and garner support for Catalan business but also for the independence issue. And he actually went there and was refused access to any high-ranking politician, so it made the news, particularly in Madrid, saying that he's going on this big mission but he's wasting all this money but not actually achieving anything.
And tell me, Liam, under the Spanish constitution, the referendum would need to be approved by the central government, who have said quite openly that they will block it. How would Catalonia ever be able to declare its independence without the government of Spain's backing?
Well, this has been an issue before because they did actually vote for their Estatut, which is kind of their own regional constitution, and 86% of the population voted for it, and then it was a few articles in particular were overturned in the Constitutional Court. So because of this historical context, Mas has really been saying that they would call the referendum anyway and just to show the people of the will and really challenge the government to overturn it once again. And this is going to be counterproductive if they do kind of go on this confrontational path, because it would just inflame independent tensions. I think when I was in Barcelona just recently talking to a lot of politicians and people, the big issue was not necessarily that they want to be independent, although a lot of people do. It's that Madrid shouldn't have the right to tell them whether their vote is valid or not. So this is the central pillar of the issue.
Monocle's Madrid correspondent Liam Aldous, thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House, and after this short break, we'll be heading to Serbia to find out about the election fever that seems to be getting grip there 4 years before the actual elections.
The menu is Monocle 24's weekly look at good food, great drinks, and the makers behind these experiences. Each week we serve up the latest in cuisine around the world, from top chefs to tiny breweries and, of course, the best baristas.
Coffees that really stand out, that jump off the table, is what we're always looking for.
On the latest edition we are talking Swiss cheese, Italian wines, Colombian rum, and we find out about a job in Chicago that is attracting the attention of a few top chefs.
I checked out his menu. It looked like some good stuff. I like what I'm doing. I hope I don't screw it up. I'm freaking out a bit right now.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
This Christmas, Monocle invite you to Midori House for our first Christmas fair. Mixing up the best of Swedish Yule, Japanese Christmaser, and traditional English Yuletide, we'll be serving up festive cheer at the most elegant Christkindlmarkt in the heart of W1. We'll have live music with a Swedish choir, food by Granger & Co, and our hand-picked retailers can help you with your Christmas shopping. Plus, you can meet a real, live reindeer. So, head to number 1 Dorset Street on the 1st and 2nd of December from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. to meet our Finnish Santa and all his little helpers at the Monocle Christmas Fair.
You're listening to Midori House. It's 1815 here in London. It's 1915 in Belgrade, where we're headed now. Although general elections are only scheduled for 2016, Serbia's pro-Western Democratic Party has already announced a new leader who could potentially reboot the party after their poor showing in this year's election. Belgrade's mayor, 45-year-old Dragan Djilas, a former anti-Milosevic student hero turned media tycoon, won the overwhelming majority of votes. To tell us more about him, we're joined now by our correspondent in Serbia, Guy Delaunay. Guy, thank you very much. So Dragan Djilas is the mayor of Belgrade currently. Tell us a little bit more about him.
Well, he's one of the few popular Democrat Party politicians at the moment. He's won a second term as Belgrade mayor, which is an indication that people in this city, capital of Serbia, former capital of Yugoslavia, of course, think that he's actually moving the city forward, or at least stopping it from going backwards, which is quite an impression to make, really. The Democrat Party, of which he is now the leader, needs all the help it can get, frankly, because at the last election earlier this year in May, it got about the coalition that it had led got about 22% of the vote. Its popularity now is somewhere below 20%, and it's looking at serious problems, really, if it wants to get back into power. So people have, after a bit of infighting, which you'd expect after that sort of election result, they've decided they really do need to send a signal to voters that something is changing. And Djilas is the obvious man to come in and try and shake that up. He is, you know, everything from a hero as a student protester, a student leader, one of the founders of the formerly radical B92 broadcast network, right up to being what his political opponents described when he first ran for Belgrade mayor, as a tycoon, a media tycoon, an advertising tycoon. So he's had a few different lives in a way, Dragan Djilas, and this is the latest of them.
Well, that always helps. What has he actually pledged to do? I mean, I know that the party's recently been beset by corruption scandals with a former Minister of Environment and of Agriculture charged by prosecutors. What can he do, really, in the 4 years until the elections?
Well, I can't guarantee you it'll be 4 years until the elections. That's a very important point to make for starters. I was having lunch with a diplomat in Belgrade today, and he was saying, well, you never know. There could be something next year, because the government at the moment is a coalition government. It is, rather confusingly, has a prime minister, Ivica Dacic, who's from the DPS party, the SPS party. This gets confusing, all these different initials, but basically the former party of Milosevic is the prime minister, but they're the minority partner in the coalition. It's actually the progressives who are leading the coalition, and the first deputy prime minister, Aleksandar Vučić, is currently the most popular man in Serbia because he's leading this anti-corruption drive. And among those that have become ensnared in it were, as you've mentioned, a couple of former Democrat ministers. Now, this gets very complicated very quickly, but the question is how soon Vučić and the progressives are going to get tired of their coalition partners and attempt to either win power outright or form a new coalition with different partners. What basically Dragan Djilas needs to do for the Democrats is get them into a position as quickly as possible that they're an electable prospect, that they're not only going to be condemned to being a junior partner in a coalition or a fringe party. That's a very real possibility if they don't get things sorted out. He needs to give the impression he's whipping them into shape. He's getting firm policies in place, particularly on the economy. One in four people here at least don't have a job. The economy's been struggling, double-digit inflation. He needs to come up with convincing policies on those issues very quickly indeed, in case there's an early election.
Indeed. And Djilas, mayor of Belgrade for two terms, obviously has a huge support base in Belgrade, but he has a lot of support outside as well, does he?
Well, I'm not really sure about that. I'll put it to the test when I go to Novi Sad tomorrow. We'll find out what people outside of the capital think of him. I mean, you often find in Serbia that there is a split, as you would find in many countries, that there's a split between the urban centres and what's going on in the provinces or in the countryside. And this is still, in many respects, a very agrarian country, agriculture terribly important still to Serbia's economy and people's livelihoods. So this is, of course, one of the tests that he's going to have to pass. whether he can convince people in the country outside of Belgrade, as well as he's been able to do the urban dwellers. They've been impressed with his efficiency in Belgrade, keeping the city working. And now he's got to persuade the other people that he can get the rest of the country working too.
Indeed. Well, we'll have to check in with you when you're in the provinces to test the temperature there. Guy Delaunay, our man in Belgrade, thank you very much for joining us. Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Hugo MacDonald. Now, the appointment of the next head of the Bank of England was announced this afternoon by Chancellor George Osborne, and it came as a surprise for many. The Bank of Canada's Governor, Mark Carney, will take the reins of the 300-year-old institution from Sir Mervyn King in July. Britain is no stranger to appointing non-nationals in key positions at the central bank. In recent decades, we've seen two Americans and one Australian in charge there. But to tell us more about this appointment and what Mark Carney has ahead of him, we've now got Keith Campbell, Bloomberg's finance editor, on the phone. Keith, thank you very much for joining us. Mark Carney was indeed a surprise appointment, not least because he himself had said that he wasn't in the running. How did that happen?
Yes, he'd been very cagey. We don't really know. There have been discussions, obviously, between the Canadian government and the UK government, prime ministers and the finance ministers for some time. People weren't calling this even up until today. Even over the last weekend, there was a report in the British press saying Paul Tucker was likely to take the role. So it's a big surprise.
We heard in the news bulletin at the top of the hour a few minutes ago that George Osborne, the Chancellor, came out with tremendous supportive words for Mark Carney. It does seem to have a very good CV. Do you think he is a suitable candidate?
Everyone seems to agree so. The interesting thing is when you talk to people, say a Davos Economic Forum, people in finance at banks or Canadian government, everybody just has great things to say about this guy and says he's the smartest central banker out there. It was interesting when I was watching in the House today, after Osborne had mentioned that Carney was to take the job, Ed Balls, the shadow chancellor, a very formidable force, to say the least, in the Labour Party came on, and he was almost as effusive about Carney as the Chancellor was.
Indeed, and the readers of Reader's Digest once voted Mark Carney the most trusted Canadian too.
The Justin Bieber and Ryan Gosling of financial markets.
But what will he have to do when he takes over the post in July? What will be the immediate things that he has to grapple with, do you think?
Well, George Osborne has said he's remaking the Bank of England. It will be, some people feel, the most powerful central bank in the world after he's done with it. So it won't be just a matter of deciding whether to raise interest rates or lower them. And there's also the small matter that he has to decide whether the Bank of England will start printing money again, otherwise known as quantitative easing. But not just that, there's going to be a stability mandate, and that means more oversight of banks, more trying to figure out if we're heading for a shock as we had in 2008. That was just so very traumatic for the UK, with banks getting taken over. And I mean, you know, the Royal Bank of Scotland and Lloyds are still controlled by the taxpayer. So while that's the Chancellor's decision when to sell those off, Mr. Carney is going to be very involved in how the financial system as a whole is considered to be stable.
Mm. And a couple of words on Sir Mervyn King, the outgoing head of the bank. Will we be remembering him in a fond light, do you think?
I think, you're going to have to wait for the big bios to come out in retirement. There's no shortage of praise and criticism for Mervyn King's role in the crisis. By some measures, he was considered to have moved very quickly. By other measures, he took a lot of criticism. There are certain accounts that consider him to have been rather, immune to criticism or not wanting to listen to dissenting voices. But the thing is, in the 2008 crisis, the situation moved so quickly that it's hard to know who could have done better.
Indeed. And finally, Keith, has there been any response in the markets following the announcement today?
Yes, the Canadian dollar came off a little bit. The general feeling in Canada was that it's going to be sad, and, you know, I'm a Canadian, reading a lot of Canadian media, that Canada is going to be sad to lose him. He was viewed as a force for stability, and, you know, in Canada, we didn't have bank failures. Our financial system stayed stable. We generally, you know, we try to be self-effacing in Canada, but there's a lot of smugness about how we came out of the financial crisis with less damage than many other countries. So I think the country will miss him.
Well, we look forward to welcoming Keith Campbell, Mark Carney to our shores next year. Keith Campbell, Bloomberg's finance editor, thank you very much indeed for joining us. And we've time for a bit of music before we have the news headlines at the bottom of the hour. This is Jamie Woon with Night Air.
Night air has the strangest flavour. Space to breathe it, time to say.
That was Jamie Woon with Night Air there. In the next half hour on Minori House, we'll be taking a look at the shared roots of Islamic and Western cultures with author and historian John Tolan. We'll also drop in on our New York bureau to hear what burning topics Aisha Spears is chewing over as she enjoys her lunch. But first, here's David Spencer with the news headlines.
Thank you. Demonstrations are continuing in Cairo's Tahrir Square as the Egyptian president claims the country will survive the latest political crisis. Protesters are angry at a new decree which has given President Mohamed Morsi sweeping new powers. More than 500 people have been injured in nationwide protests. Syrian activists say 10 children have been killed after a government jet dropped a cluster bomb on a playground in a village east of Damascus. The government has denied that the military has any cluster bombs. Eurozone finance ministers are in Brussels alongside the head of the International Monetary Fund to try to hammer out a deal that will unfreeze the second bailout package for Greece. It's the third time they've met. The UK government has made a surprise choice for the next governor of the Bank of England. Canadian central bank chief Mark Carney will take over from Mervyn King in July next year. And shares of two loss-making private Indian airlines, SpiceJet and Jet Airways, have risen sharply following reports that foreign carriers are in talks about buying stakes in the operators. SpiceJet says it is very premature to comment on the possibility of any deal. Jet Airways has declined to comment. That's the latest on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're coming to you live from London. Now, you'd be forgiven for thinking that European and Islamic civilizations are worlds apart from much of the inflammatory rhetoric employed by the media today. But the reality is, of course, very different. And anyone with a modicum of intelligence and ability to see beyond the headlines knows that the two cultures are often inextricably linked. A new book published by Princeton called Europe and the Islamic World, A History, does what it says on the tin and charts a rigorous chew through the cultural histories of Europe and the Islamic world, educating and enlightening on what they share and what they owe to each other. We're joined now by one of the three authors of the book, John Tolan. John, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
It's quite a big topic.
Absolutely. We're just listening to the headlines from Damascus and Cairo tonight, and the headlines just about any evening over the last years, and obviously it's a big topic. As you say, it's a topic that extremists on both sides are ready to run with, and to make us think that there's this clash of civilizations, to use the words of Samuel Huntington, and extremists on the other side are ready to say that Muslim values should be the same from Indonesia to Morocco, when in fact there's a rich and varied group of cultures, of course, within what we call Islam, what we call the West, and there's been a tremendous intermixing of cultures ever since the Middle Ages.
Indeed, and I mean, to that extent, the book couldn't be more timely. But actually, having a flick through it, it seems like throughout history, this book could have been written to sort of educate and enlighten inflammatory people that have always existed since the dawn of Islam.
That's right. There's always been, of course, it was often a religious confrontation between Christians and Muslims. In the medieval West, the Muslim world was seen as both tantalizing and threatening. Tantalizing because it was a world of greater riches, both financial and cultural and intellectual, than were in Western Europe for centuries. Dangerous, of course, both militarily, from the Arab conquest of Spain through Ottoman conquests into Europe. Dangerous also religiously, of course, because Islam was seen as a religious rival. From the other side, one of the things we've tried to do, and this kind of book has been written many times before, but often from the point of view of Europeans. And we wanted to try to look at both points of view, or rather not both points of view, because these are not, as I said, two monolithic entities, but from multiple points of view. What do Europeans, or Franks, as they call them, look to a merchant in Tunis or a sultan in Cairo, as well as what Arabs or Saracens looked like to a Bede riding in Northumbria or perhaps to a Genoese merchant. So the idea was to multiply the angles of perspective to see that this is not simply us against them, but this is a complex and rich history of contact, with, of course, its share of conflict.
Indeed. And I mean, you talk about the taking sort of slightly unusual perspectives of people, everyday people. Does that mean that you've had to go through a lot of original source material that hasn't sort of been addressed in this way before?
Well, this is a book that covers many centuries, and of course, a lot of it has been based on the work of historians over the last 30, 50 years. Some of it, the work that I myself and my two co-authors, Gilles Weinstein and Henri Laurence, have done, and then a lot of it, a work of other historians writing in French, in English, in various other languages.
Mm. The book itself is, I mean, it's fascinating and incredibly rigorous. Does it have appeal, do you think, outside academic circles as well?
I think so. We've tried to write for the learned layman. So it's not a book meant for academics. It's a book meant to bring the subject to a wider audience and to educate those who want to know behind the headlines what is the rich and deep history of the interaction, say, between Egypt and Europe. Egypt, you know, goes back, of course, to British presence in Egypt, to Napoleon's conquest, but also to the presence of Genoese and Venetian merchants in the Middle Ages, to crusaders who tried to take some of Egypt's cities, and so forth. So it's a rich and long history, and if you want to understand the headlines, you need to read deeper.
And presumably not just to understand the headlines, but to think about potential ways that the problems that the Middle East is facing, and also the problems that we sort of look at them through the lens of the West, that, you know, they could potentially be solved from looking at the past too.
That's right. We can, of course, the history can't necessarily find solutions to the problems, but at least we can help understand them better, and we can at least avoid some errors. And I think avoiding the errors of essentializing these differences is big, because that's what we're seeing, as I said earlier, from both sides, an attempt on some, the extremists on both sides, to say, no, there's nothing we can do. We need to we sort of need to keep the conflict going. If you listen to Hamas, if you listen to some of the ideologues of in Netanyahu's cabinet, you have the idea that no solution is possible. We need to get beyond that.
John Tolan, author of Europe and the Islamic World, thank you very much indeed for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. We're off to the Congo after this.
On Monocle's Culture Show, we want to be like the fabled Hydra, one of the great monsters of Greek myth, but in a good way. Listen to one fascinating story and two more eagerly pop up to replace it. So it's only scary if you're frightened of the following sorts of things. Reports from all over the world on art, books, magazines, media, music, film, publishing, advertising, and photography. Or if you're terrified of beautifully performed, intimate live music sessions from some of our favourite acts recorded in our performance space right here at Midori House. It's Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. It premieres on Mondays at 1900 London time, and frankly, it's the heroic Hercules that defeats the evil Hydra of radio boredom. Join us and enjoy the legend.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 18:39 here in London. It's been almost a week since a group of Congolese rebels known as M23 took the city of Goma, the largest in eastern Congo, without a gun being fired. The army fled, and the UN peacekeepers looked on, deciding their mandate didn't allow them to intervene. What the M23 want, and what they're likely to do next, is still unclear. Allegedly backed by two of Congo's neighbours, Rwanda and Uganda, M23 has threatened to march on the capital, Kinshasa. Ben Rawlins, author of Radio Congo, came into Midori House a little earlier to speak to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, who, like Ben, has also reported extensively from eastern Congo.
I think there's no surprise that we see a big resurgence of the stereotypes about Congo in its heart of darkness, Congo in its irretrievably hopeless situation, and rape and conflict minerals and so on, although, of course, it's about more than that. But what I'm quite surprised about, actually, is the very positive spin that seems to be placed on M23. Yes, journalists, certainly Western journalists, are mentioning some of the negative reports about their human rights violations, but at the same time, they're talking about their crisp uniforms, their discipline, their well-organisedness, and almost with a sort of nostalgia or, you know, longing for what would Eastern Congo be like if M23 were in charge, because the Rwandans, of course, are backing them, and they're so much more organised than these hopeless Congolese. So I've been a little bit surprised about that, and a little bit concerned, because I'm worried that some journalists might be being taken for a ride.
Is there a danger in these situations that there is reporters looking at what's going on, hope that there are some good guys somewhere, or some less bad guys?
Well, this is a problem that I think we've seen with journalists getting too close to the story, and journalists wanting to be aid workers or wanting to be activists or feeling that somehow their journalism has to matter, rather than just doing their job and reporting what they're seeing and exercising due diligence to make sure that their translator is neutral, that the people that they're speaking to are being brought to them actually on a random basis, they're not being put in front of them. And that's a tendency I've seen over and over, especially with respect to Africa, rather than a more neutral, dispassionate reporting with the sort of professional confidence that that is what your job is.
And is part of that problem that many of the journalists that are covering what's happening in eastern Congo are coming in? They're most either coming from Nairobi or from Johannesburg, some coming in from London, and they perhaps don't know all the nuances on the ground as well as perhaps they could?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of very good professional people there, and there's a lot of very good coverage coming out. But there are one or two accounts that definitely stick out that do seem to be slightly odd, and there's certainly a general kind of feeling of wanting to be able to cling on to something, as you say, yeah. And I think that affects everybody, regardless of your experience in the game.
Well, and perhaps actually, if you've covered Congo for a while, you might like the idea that, you know, that someone's going to come in and sort things out.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I've definitely seen that tendency more marked among diplomats and, you know, some of the UN people and so on. And that's quite dangerous.
When we look at what M23 are doing now, you go back 4 years ago and, you know, its precursor, the CNDP, did something very similar. They very easily marched through eastern Congo. They got to the gates of Goma and then decided not to enter the town and to hold back. Why do you think M23 have taken Goma and now talking about going further?
Well, this is the $64 million question that none of the analysts seem to have been able to answer, is why go the whole hog? And, you know, is Rwanda actually behind that final decision? It would seem so. And what have they got to win? And it's clear who the loser is, but it's not entirely clear who the winners will be in the long term, because either M23 have to go the whole hog to try and take Kinshasa to justify this preliminary move, or they've got to then negotiate. But what are they going to negotiate on the basis of an illegal occupation of a town backed by a foreign power? So they can only really retreat from that. So it's very complicated, and I would certainly like to see more analysis and more reflection about what are the big powers at play here. It seems to me there's definitely an economic angle. The neglected part of the UN Group of Experts report was on the mining violations of the sanctions. The bit that everybody focuses on is the bit that talked about Rwandan and Ugandan involvement and backing for M23. But there's actually a very detailed analysis of all of the clandestine smuggling to circumvent the tagging initiatives that have been making some quite good progress to identify conflict minerals. So I think there's definitely an economic aspect to this, to Rwanda's sort of illegal trade and Uganda's. And then, of course, there's some regional geopolitical stuff to do with Rwandan influence in Eastern Congo more generally.
Now, Rwanda and Uganda have both insisted that they have absolutely no involvement in this. They certainly don't back M23, although Rwanda has denied things like this in the past, and that's been proved to be wrong. Uganda, despite saying they're not involved in any way, have also said if we tell M23 not to go any further, they won't go any further, which raises some questions over what influence or otherwise they might have. Can any pressure be put on those two countries to change the situation on the ground?
Absolutely. I mean, those are the key actors. That's why the international community has focused their pressure and their attention on them. That's why Uganda is playing brinkmanship with its peacekeepers in Somalia. That's why
by threatening to pull them out.
To pull them out. That's why aid to Rwanda has been cut or frozen and now probably cut. And that's why South Africa and others are aiming their comments at Rwanda and Uganda. So they are absolutely the key players. They are they're the ones who, by all accounts, do seem to be in control of M23, despite what they say. But I think the West, having cut aid, it now has very few levers left, unless we start talking about more punitive steps like sanctions and other kind of things like that.
There are two episodes from recent Congolese history that have been brought to mind by what's happened here. One is when Laurent Kabila, the father, now dead father of Joseph Kabila, the current Congolese president, took a rebel group backed by Rwanda and Uganda from the east and marched all the way to Kinshasa and ousted Mobutu Sese Seko. That's one scenario. The other is the war around that time that brought in 8-9 countries within the region, including Angola, including Zimbabwe and so on. Do repeats of either of those scenarios look possible at the moment? Improbable perhaps, but possible?
I mean, that's very much the framework within which people are discussing the scenario. The 1996-7 march across the country, and in fact then the second Congo War, as it's called, after 98, when Laurent Kabila turned around and said, no, Rwandans, go home, thanks very much. And then they didn't.
And they said, no, we quite like it here.
Yeah, and we're making lots of money, thank you very much. And then he had to invite Angola and all the others in on his behalf, and everybody got involved. And there's been shades of that again, because Kabila Jr. has requested Angola to step in and support him. South Africa has been making comments about a neutral force, whatever that means. So, yes, both of those scenarios. I think the second one perhaps more likely at this point. But with a bit of luck, we can avoid both. And with sufficient pressure on Uganda and Rwanda, we might be able to see some sort of negotiated solution in the east.
That was Ben Rawlins, author of Radio Congo, speaking to Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield earlier there. And we've got time for a song now. This is The Sound of Arrows by Wonders. That was Wonders by The Sound of Arrows there. You're listening to Midori House with me, Hugo MacDonald. The time in London is 18:53, and it's time now to say good afternoon to America, specifically to New York, where our bureau chief Aisha Spears joins us now on the line. Hello, Aisha.
Hello, Hugo. How are you?
Very well indeed. Thank you. It's been a very busy weekend, well, and Friday as well, with Black Friday and then Small Business Saturday and Cyber Monday, I gather, too. What's that about?
I know. So it's kind of these awfully branded days which follow the Thanksgiving holiday, which happened last Thursday. So traditionally, you've got Black Friday, which is the big sales day in bricks and mortar stores. It kind of heralds the beginning of the Christmas shopping season.
Death in the aisles in Walmart.
It is. I mean, there are people who have been trampled to death in Walmart. And so there's all sorts of restrictions now. But you can, you know, every year on the news during Black Friday, there's some horrific scenes of people hitting each other over the head to get the latest Wii or stuffed toy or whatever it is that they're trying to get for their kids or televisions. You know, you can get a television for, I don't know, 10% of the price. People line up overnight. So that's Friday. Small Business Saturday is a new, slightly more recent edition, and that's to go and support the small businesses in your neighborhood. And then Cyber Monday, which is a day which is kind of lots of sales across e-commerce. But the interesting thing is, because it's now spread over these 4 days, it started early this year on Thursday night, so it kind of bled into Thanksgiving holiday. The actual sales numbers went down on Friday, 1.8% decrease, but that's still $11 billion worth of sales on Friday. So more people kind of spreading their shopping over the weekend rather than just hitting it on Friday.
Indeed, and Cyber Monday following up today, I mean, it's interesting because I was speaking to some people over the weekend who said that the whole Black Friday phenomenon has slightly run dry a little bit, just because so many people wait to get the discounts online and they don't have to face all those elbows and fists on Friday. Do you think Cyber Monday might end up being the death of Black Friday?
It might be. And on Friday itself, even before Cyber Monday was upon us, I wish they didn't have such annoying names, but even before Cyber Monday had hit, there was a 20% increase on online sales on Friday. So I think a lot of people are happier to stay at home, having kind of been a bit, you know, full with all the turkey they ate on Thursday and click buttons rather than head out and fight the lines in Kmart and Walmart and all those kind of places.
Indeed. Well, now tell us a little bit about gun control, which has risen to the surface again in New York.
It has. So gun control, which is a huge issue, of course, in the US, sadly, it wasn't mentioned very much during the presidential campaign. There was one question asked of both Obama and Romney during the town hall debate, which they both kind of swept over because neither really wants to approach the gun control issue. Ray Kelly, who's the police commissioner here in New York, has spoken out against Obama following the accidental shooting of a 5-year-old girl in the Bronx. And Ray Kelly said, you know, it's not just a local problem. The city that's most affected by guns is Chicago, and that's the president's hometown, but he hasn't said anything about it. So it's a kind of quite clear call to arms, or not arms, I guess, you know, for the New York police force, saying to the president he should be doing more about curbing gun use and people getting caught in the crossfires across the US.
So you'd think Obama would have to respond to that fairly soon, surely?
I don't think he will. I mean, because the mayor of Chicago is his former chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, and he's the person who's really kind of helming the attempt to get guns off the streets in that town. But New York has quite strict gun laws. A lot of the country doesn't, and it's a constant battle that the president has to handle. But both the NRA, who have a huge lobby here, and then all the people who don't, especially predominantly in urban areas, who don't want guns to be accessible and people to be able to use them because of the kind of things that we saw over the weekend with accidental shootings.
Indeed, and we've got just about a minute left to hear about a surprising absence of Jewish candidates in New York's mayoral election next year. What's going on there?
Indeed. So New York City is the largest Jewish population outside of Israel. There's 1.5 million Jews in the city. But this is the first time, perhaps, that we might see, not the first time, first in a long time, that we might see no candidate, no Jewish candidate for the mayoral election next year because Scott Stringer has pulled out. So perhaps it's not a case of race and religion really being the key for people to vote for now.
And what does the Jewish community have to say when something like that surfaces?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the person who seems to have the most support is a female, Christine Quinn, who's a woman and also a lesbian. And so it doesn't seem that people need to necessarily vote with their religion or with their race anymore.
Well, Aisha Spears, our New York bureau chief over in New York City. Enjoy your lunch. Thank you very much for joining us. And that's all we've got time for today on Midori House, I'm afraid. Thank you very much to our producer, Marcus Hippie, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Next up, Robert Bounds getting musical on a brand new edition of Culture, including a report from the International Music Industry Showcase in Canada. That's M for Montreal.
You can work, you can come and do shows, but the idea that live is going to break a francophone act in the UK, it's not like a workable strategy.
And then in 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours here in London, Emma Nelson and Tamsin Smith will be back for the Monocle Daily. Ted Kravitz will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Hugo MacDonald, thank you for listening. Goodbye.